This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
The University of Central Florida is still dealing with the fallout over the misspending of more than $38 million in state money. The Florida Board of Governors, which oversees all state universities, meets tomorrow in Miami to discuss what to do over the misappropriations. The Florida House Public Ethics and Integrity Committee has also been investigating the misspent money, with one board member calling it, quote, a multi-year strategy to misspend money. Five people have lost their jobs over the scandal. Some of them say they are being scapegoated. Today on Intersection, we'll talk to Bill Merk. He's the former University of Central Florida chief financial officer, forced to resign last year over the incident. Also hear from Chuck Green. He's an attorney representing Merk and several of the people who've been fired over the incident. 90.7's Abab Araya, who's been following the case. And a note, we've also reached out to the University of Central Florida to be part of this panel. However, they did not have anyone available at this time. Well, Bill Merk, I want to welcome you to Intersection. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
And also Chuck Green, thanks for being here too.
You're welcome. Good morning.
And Abab Araya, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Abe, I want to start with you. Just give us a background to how we got here.
So essentially what happened was with Colburn Hall, it's the, you know, it's one of the older buildings on university campus, built in the 1970s. The building has had structural issues. In fact, as when I was a news editor for the Central Florida Future, we actually ran articles about how the elevators did not work in the building. So this is a building that has had issues for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. You know, in the broader context of things, there was public education capital outlay. It's a stream of funding that, you know, the state allocates for funding for universities as well as public schools. And over, you know, starting with the Great Recession, this fund dropped from, you know, more than $1 billion to just tens of millions of dollars for the entire system. Mm-hmm. And so you saw schools that had a growing enrollment and a growing university population and a greater need for more facilities. And at the same time, you saw less funding for that as, you know, the Great Recession took a hit and the funding streams for that dropped. So the bottom line was, you know, there was a lot of need for new facilities. And we also at the same time had these, the University of Central Florida had education and general appropriation funds. So these are funds that are sent for, you know, if you have a professor and you allocate $100,000 for to hire a professor and maybe another $100,000 for a lab, but maybe it takes 6 months to actually, you know, hire this person and bring them on board, then you have half that money left over. That money carries forward into the next year. So this mm-hmm. is the, you know, what they call the E&G funds. And so these funds carry forward year over year. And so they can be used legally, according to Board of Governor recommendations and regulations, they can be used for some renovation projects. And there's precedent for that where, you know, you can use these for, you know, smaller projects, maybe less than $2 million. Where the issues came in was these funds being used for new construction. So the background here is Colburn Hall, mm-hmm. Built in the 70s, needed to be renovated. The cost for renovation kept ballooning and ballooning, and there kept being more and more issues found with Colburn Hall. Mm-hmm. And so the you know, decision was made to start using these E&G funds for new construction rather than just the renovation project that was originally talked about. And that's where you get this $38 million number for building a new Colburn Hall, Trevor Colburn Hall, and basically destroying the old Colburn Hall built in the 70s.
So, and if I'm understanding it correctly, that the auditors said, look, essentially money was being used from the wrong bucket to pay for these renovations.
This money can't be used for new construction or anything that can extend the use or the life of the building.
Mm-hmm. I know we've been sort of delving into some numbers, but I just wondered if we go a little bit bigger, what was the context of this decision? I mean, you mentioned the recession, so there was some financial strictures in place.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, it's you went from you know, a system that had a funding stream that was designed for allowing universities to have a pretty regular stream of money coming in for building new projects. Mm-hmm. But that pretty much all completely tanked after the Great Recession. And then, you know, Governor Rick Scott, when he came in, he was actually concerned about the amount of money that the state was bonding out, how many, you know, loans for, you know, in the, mm-hmm. you know, air quotes, you know, how much the state was borrowing on these monies. So we actually saw the state just completely stop bonding money on this. And so you saw that stream went from, you know, being A plus B to just A, but A was completely desecrated by the recession.
Mm-hmm. As we noted at the top of this conversation, we did reach out to the University of Central Florida. They were unable to provide somebody to join the panel, but we have heard from the university. Just want to hear for a little bit of tape. This is the university president, Dale Whitaker.
I had a higher responsibility for inquiry because of my executive vice president role. I had an obligation to the university that in hindsight I missed. And this is why I said on Friday that I accept the wisdom of this board to eliminate 2 years of performance pay.
Abe Abaride, if you could just explain the context of what we heard from Dale Whitaker. First of all, what was that hearing about?
So one of the things that happened in the course of this was the UCF board chairman, Marcos Marchena, one of the recommendations he had was to go back and eliminate the performance pay for Dale Whitaker, the current UCF president, because of this incident. And so this is, by our calculations, it could be anywhere from, you know, tens of thousands to more than $100,000 worth of performance pay that's eliminated. And as we heard in that tape there, you know, Dale Whitaker basically saying, hey, listen, I understand that I had a higher role of review when it comes to this and I should have been paying more attention. And so I'll go ahead and accept that. And it's worth mentioning that, you know, Bill Merck is here as well. And he also has had his performance pay withheld by the state university. That was another decision that the board made as well. And at one point they were actually talking about going after Bill Merck's retirement funding, which, you know, Marcos Marchena actually mentioned that he didn't think that, you know, what happened at the University of Central Florida rose to the level of going after retirement pay in the Florida retirement system. But, you know, it was at least talked about at one point.
Can I address what Abe said earlier about the
Certainly.
The context in which the decisions concerning Colburn Hall and Trevor Colburn Hall were made? There is no specific state statute on point that forbids the use of E&G carry forward to fund capital projects. Rather, there's a Board of Governors rule or regulation. That was just adopted at the end of 2013, right when these decisions were made, and wasn't widely known or widely disseminated. What was known by the universities was there was a general policy that you didn't use E&G to fund capital projects. But at the same time, the universities had carry forward from E&G and other things, and not all the universities had them. UCF benefited from the wise money management of Bill Merck and others, and so they had a pot of funds available in a carry forward pool. And they were getting conflicting directions from the state. You know, you've got restrictions on what you can use carry forward for. At the same time, they're being reprimanded almost and told you can't have carry forward. You have to spend it down. So it was in the context of having this carry forward funds available that the Trevor Colburn or the Colburn Hall emergency arose. And it was a real emergency because four different engineering firms inspected the building and issued a report that it was full of mold, that it had structural deterioration, that there were bricks falling off the facade. And it was going to fail within about a 2-year period and something needed to be done. So there was an emergency, and all the people involved set out to try to find an answer to cure this real emergency. And they were trying to do the right thing by replacing. It started off as a renovation project to the old building. That became economically infeasible, and it morphed into the development of the new Trevor Colburn Hall. But the decision was made to use the carry forward funds to fund that. It wasn't E&G that was designated for use in a particular year. Is actually funds that were left over. And so it was the context of this economic emergency in the state and this emergency that affected real people at UCF that led to the decisions that we're here about today.
Bill Merck, is that kind of how you see it?
Absolutely, and I'll add to that the context of the time, and that was, and we all knew that Colburn Hall was in very bad shape and was getting worse. And there was a need to do something. As an officer of the university, not just chief financial officer, but vice president for administration and finance, I and others that are in those types of positions have a real responsibility for the safety and of our students, faculty, and staff. And knowing that that building had the potential, if it had not already begun, to cause serious health problems for the students, the faculty and staff in that building, And because of the structural problems to physically injure someone down the road, I knew we had to do something. Mm-hmm. There was, and so we, in the absence of the normal funds that Abe described earlier that you would get from the state to do these kind of jobs, we dipped into the cash balances that we had at the time. And I strongly believe that the priorities of taking care of our people were and should be continue to be at the top of the list of things that we're concerned about.
And it sounds like from what your attorney, Chuck Green, just told us that as far as you and I'm gathering other universities understood at the time, that money could be used, those carry over funds could be used for funding construction of the likes of Colburn Hall.
There was confusion about that among my colleagues as well as the folks on my staff.
I want to ask you something, Bill Merk, about a comment that's been reported from you. According to several people in the independent investigation, you said the decision to use this money would lead to, quote, an audit comment. Right. What did you mean by that?
We've already had the discussion about how the funding worked from the state and the drop in the funding and the cash balances that we had. And I was not aware of any projects of this size, $38 million, being funded from those ENG carry-forward sources before. That being the case, I just expected that the auditors would spot that, raise it as a point to discuss in an audit. And so, I mean, I just expected that there would be some fallout from the auditors, and I was fairly free in my comments about that.
I guess there has been fallout, but it's been a little heavier.
Way, way out of proportion to what I thought it would be. I thought it would be something relatively straightforward, something that reasonable people, when they understood why we did what we did, there may be some consideration that was a transgression of some sort, but in the grand scheme of things, very minor compared to the life safety of the people in that building. That was what we were trying to take care of.
Can I follow up with that, though? Because, you know, with the argument that this is a life safety, issue, and I don't think anyone's really arguing that when it came to Colburn Hall, that there were issues there. But there were all these other instances of, I think it was 11 more appropriations for ENG carry forward for capital projects. And then upwards, including Colburn and all these ones that had been spent, around $85 million. Were they all in that category of life safety? Or did you sort of look at that as saying, well, we sort of broke the barrier of, okay.
No. They were all standalone circumstances. And the example would be the band shelter. We were undergoing an accreditation review for the music department. And one of the comments in the by the accreditors was, you have a situation here that needs remedy. If you cannot produce a band shelter for these people to retreat to in these thunderstorms, we see that as something that could damage your reaccreditation. So in our response, we pledged that we would develop some sort of a shelter for them, and we cobbled together money to do that from various sources. Some of that, I think, was probably some of the ENG carry forward, but I couldn't be specific about it because at that time we weren't thinking that this was a problem that would be discussed in the way that it is today. Mm-hmm. It was not even on the radar as problematic. We were very proud to have done it.
And just to that end as well, talking about responsibility, et cetera, we should mention that John Hitt, who retired but was being paid about $300,000 a year in retirement to help fundraise, has asked to work for free for the rest of the year. What about this notion then? I mean, you're not the only person who is kind of on receiving the brunt of this, or on the receiving end of this investigation, this audit. Bill Merk, a bunch of other people have lost their jobs as well. Do you feel like you're a scapegoat for this?
I was the point person for developing an excuse for others to shed their responsibility for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It expanded out to others beyond me as time went on, but I was the villain in the piece from the beginning.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking with Bill Merk, the University of Central Florida's former chief financial officer, his attorney, Chuck Green, and 90.7's Abe Abaraya about the misspending of $38 million of state money.
Well, Chuck Green, can I ask you then? I mean, there are four employees besides Bill Merk have been fired because of this. Do you represent all of those employees?
I represent at least one of them. I represent other people that haven't been fired. I represent several people associated with the university whose goal is to get out the whole truth, which I believe and others believe has been concealed, that the role of leadership, people who knew what was going on, has been downplayed, while a knowledge of wrongdoing has been attributed to others that just didn't exist.
But it sounds like, from your point of view, there was no wrongdoing.
I'm not saying that at all. There was a rule was violated. I think there's things at UCF that need to be fixed, but I think the problems are on both ends, that there needed to be clearer communication from the state as to what was allowed, and maybe clearer. Once that's done, I think that will fix the problem at UCF. I don't think that anyone at UCF, there's no evidence anywhere, and I've looked at literally hundreds of emails and thousands of pages of documents that we've gathered to try to follow the investigation that was done by Joe Berbe. There's nothing in those papers anywhere that anybody thought they were doing anything wrong. Everybody had the right motives. Nobody ever says, hey, there's a statute or a rule or anything that's violated, including the general counsel.
Well, I mean, let me ask you a simple question then. Should Bill Merk or should those other employees have lost their jobs over this?
You know, should they have lost their jobs? I think if there had been a more diplomatic and patient reaction to the situation from the beginning, if Del Whitaker and Marcos Marchena had said, let's find out what happened and what we need to fix, rather than saying, let's find out who we can blame, then nobody would have lost their job. Bill made the decision to resign to try to take responsibility for those people that worked under him who were not decision makers.
So he wasn't expecting them to lose their jobs either?
They should not have lost their jobs. No. We're talking about real people who have families, whose families depend upon them for income, who weren't involved in making the decision to use these funds, who were simply carrying out the orders of others. And there's no evidence anywhere that they thought it was wrong.
So are you going to sue for wrongful termination?
We don't contemplate any legal action at this point. My goal is not to sue anybody. It's to try to get out the truth. I'd hoped that by providing information in advance of the report from the law firm that was commissioned by UCF to do this investigation, that it would have been fairer and fuller. Mm-hmm. But there was a selective omission of information that I think was designed to understate the role that Del Whitaker played in this. At the same time, a level of culpability is being attributed to these lower-level employees who had nothing to do with the decision.
I will say what I've heard Marcos Marchena say in response to that is it was mentioned as carry-forward funds, not, you know, E&G carry-forward, and that there was some sort of confusion there. But Bill Merk, I did want to ask you one question in particular, because your role while you were at the University of Central Florida has been split into two different roles now, in part because they're saying it's going to allow for more accountability and more oversight into it. You know, is that something that, you know, you support as having both of those roles in the past?
I think I think splitting the role does exactly what they intend, which is to not allow the person that goes into my position or persons to have both budget oversight and responsibility for constructing buildings. They'll separate that. So that will provide a safeguard. The other side of the coin is that when you're responsible for buildings, Every building project is just one giant problem to solve from the beginning to the end, which is typically about a 2-year process. And losing the authority and the flexibility of managing the budgets that support that construction will be a real constraint on whoever takes my place. So it's a double-edged sword, no question about it.
Let me ask then, Bill Merk, the Florida Board of Governors meets on Wednesday. What will you be looking out for or listening for during that meeting?
I think one of the topics of the meeting will be the report of the state audit. And having looked at the recommendations of the state auditor, I don't take exception to those recommendations. If they are met, I think that would be fine. I noticed on the agenda that the law firm that did the investigation is being given an opportunity to review their investigation. I don't know where that will go, and that concerns me.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see this going, Chuck Green?
What I hope to hear on Wednesday is that the investigation's not over, that they're not going to stop at Burby's report, that they'll look behind some of his conclusions, that they will see that there's some things that are understated and overstated. I'm not trying to get Bill Merk's job back. He did what he thought was the right thing by resigning. So what I hope to hear is that they're going to go on, they're going to look further into this and try to look at the whole truth, because not all of it has been told or explained. There were others that at UCF that were involved in the decision to use the funds that were used to fund Trevor Colburn Hall. And yet instead of admitting that and pointing out the fact that this was done for a good reason, you start off this show by talking about the why. The why matters. Mm. There is a very important reason that these funds were used to construct a new building: the health, safety, and welfare of the people that Dr. Hitt and Bill Merk had the responsibility to look out for. But instead of defending that decision in which they were involved, Marcus Machena and Del Whitaker, they set on a campaign to blame people. And, Bill Merck's not trying to get his job back, but the other people that were forced, they were actually given the option to resign or be fired. Two of them have asked for a hearing and are going to accept being fired if that's the ultimate decision, because they don't feel the full story has been told and that they are being scapegoated.
Abe, how do you see this playing out?
I wish I knew. I think the concern from other people at the University of Central Florida is that, particularly when you look at this House Ethics Committee that's looking into this, that there could be punitive actions for the University of Central Florida, that they actually could lose more state funding for construction or for other projects because of this. Bill Merk and I were talking about this beforehand. This is something that, he was worried about as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not speaking just about UCF, but the whole university system. We've already talked about the drop in PICO funding for new construction or for major renovations of buildings. We didn't talk about the lack of just plan operations and maintenance, just maintenance money that has been cut off in the last few years. But all of the schools are facing, I think, to one degree or another, the same problems we face with Colburn Hall. They're going to have to do or need to do something. This problem was created largely because of the lack of funding from the appropriate sources, and so we resorted to the actions that we took. To then reduce the funding as a punitive measure because of that action to the state universities, UCF included, would just exacerbate the problem, in my mind, not do anything constructive.
Well, I guess we'll be waiting to see what happens on Wednesday and from there on out. Well, I want to thank you for coming in, Bill Merk, former University of Central Florida Chief Financial Officer. Appreciate you being here.
I'm pleased to have had the opportunity to talk with you.
Also, Chuck Green, he's an attorney representing Merk and several of the folks who have been fired over this incident. Chuck, thank you as well.
Thank you.
90.7's Abe Abarai has been following the story. Abe, thanks as well.
Thank you.
Up next, there's a statewide teacher shortage, so what's the solution? Florida Education Association President Frederick Ingram says it comes down to funding. We'll have a conversation with Ingram when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida has a teacher shortage. The Florida Education Association, the state's biggest teachers union, says at the start of the school year, 4,000 classrooms did not have a fully certified teacher in front of them. FEA President Frederick Ingram says solving the teacher shortage comes down to funding. From the Education Desk this week, we talked to Ingram about what the teachers union wants to do to recruit and retain teachers.
So last year, the teacher shortage was 3,000 classrooms that we quantified, and the year before that was 2,000. And so if you look and see the trend that we're on, this is going to become monumental, and it's going to be something that is going to be very difficult to overcome in the state of Florida if we don't start to do something about what's happening inside the classroom to those who have dedicated their lives to students.
The number 4,000 sounds like a lot at the start of the year, 2,000 now, but I mean, as a proportion of classrooms that are that have teachers in front of them, what proportion would that be?
So I think it's a small proportion in most districts, but it's of epic proportion when we talk about 4,000 statewide. And I think we really have to talk about how we are recruiting teachers and the problem that we're having recruiting these teachers. We know that the schools of education around the state of Florida are, in some instances, 30% fewer students than they've had in years past. And so if we start to look at some of these things that are causing the teacher shortage, low pay, lack of autonomy for classrooms, the high-stakes testing situations that are happening. You know, teachers want to teach. They don't want to test their students. And that is what is part of what's driving our teachers away from our classrooms.
There is some bipartisan support for the idea of rolling back a little bit on things like high-stake testing, though, right? So I imagine that might be an area where you say you could make some gains, or you could make things better for teachers, because it seems like lawmakers from both sides of the aisles are interested in having less emphasis on high-stakes testing.
Sure, but I think it's a bigger and broader situation that we have to look at. So I'm a high school band director by trade. If you know anything about high school band directors, listen, we give our life, blood, and soul to these kids because we care, because we love what we do. And I think our lawmakers have to really get back and get engaged in why people teach. It's important to listen to the voice of those teachers, but it's also important to listen to the voice of the students, because they will tell you what it takes to have a qualified and certified teacher in front of them. And we're not doing enough of that here in Tallahassee. Tallahassee lawmakers, those policymakers and people who are elected to represent these different communities ought to listen to the people who are voting for them.
I remember hearing some of the comments you made on the appointment of Richard Corcoran, former House Speaker with the Florida Legislature, now as Commissioner of Education. Are you confident that you can sort of forge a good relationship with Richard Corcoran going forward and address some of these concerns, whether it's teacher retention, whether it's pay, whether it's high-stakes testing? Do you feel like there's potential for developing a good rapport with the Department of Education and moving the ball forward on some of these issues?
So the Florida Education Association is an advocacy organization. What we want is to make things right for the students first. We want to do everything possible that contributes to student success, that contributes to making good stewards of society. And if people like Richard Corcoran and the Department of Education are interested in having those conversations, we're always here to have those conversations. We have an open door policy. We've actually extended a hand for Mr. Corcoran to come to our leadership meeting and talk about some of the ideas that he has. We know what his record is as the House Speaker, and we also know what the ideology here has been for the last 20 years in the state of Florida. It has been corporate education reform, which we do not believe at the FEA is the way that we make our public schools better. And so we want to engage Mr. Corcoran. We want to make sure that we can cultivate as good of a relationship as we can, because kids matter, because our students and our communities and our families want the best for each and every kid. We've got to give each kid a shot at being a better version of themselves. And the way that we do that is through collaboration. We do that through talking and engaging and finding some common ground as it relates to our public schools. So, yes, we're optimistic.
Are there some school districts which you are particularly concerned about, or whether they're really in dire need of more qualified teachers? Are there some real standouts there that you think more attention needs to be paid to than others?
Well, certain communities have certainly risen to the top in terms of the teacher shortage. When you look at Volusia County, Palm Beach, Fort Myers, Jacksonville, Northwest Florida, even Orlando in Escambia County, we have a big concern about the teacher shortage in those areas specifically. But I think it's a deeper than the demographic problem. I think we have to talk about subject areas. Our STEM, science, technology, and mathematics are really taking the brunt of the teacher shortage, along with our elementary schools, which is the biggest teacher shortage area in the state of Florida. And so we have got to double down in our high schools, making our public schools attractive again, so that these young graduates will make the choice to go into our public schools. And we've got to cultivate this idea that if you're a second career teacher, that you are coming into a profession that matters, that we're going to do whatever it takes to recruit you and to retain you as an educator.
You mentioned before that you're training as a high school band director. And as you say, and I know from having talked to other band directors, a lot of work goes into it. A lot of it is after hours work as well. You're really pouring your entire life into the job. And it's the same with a lot of subject areas, right? From the point of view of the FEA, clearly there's some work to do, but is it still a profession which you recommend? Is there still a lot to recommend being a teacher and being a teacher in Florida?
Absolutely. I recommend that people come into education and come into teaching with, you know, bright-eyed and believing that they can change the world, because they really can. I only sit as the FEA president because of public school teachers who poured into me. I was a kid who grew up in the mean streets of Miami, in the inner city, abject poverty, generational poverty, in fact. I was the first in my family to go to college, and I wasn't, you know, an above average student, but there were some teachers, specifically my band director, who poured into me and who believed in me until I found the belief in myself. And that happens every single day for our kids. It happens every single place in the state of Florida. And what we don't talk about that we should is that kind of magic and responsibility that is entrusted in our public school teachers. That is what matters. It's not the test at the end of the day, because 20 years from now, it's not going to be your test score that defines who you are in life. It's going to be you know, what you learned as it relates to collaboration and teamwork and learning to talk to others and decision-making processes. And that's what I learned as a student. And so, yes, I believe that teaching is not only the most noble profession, but it is that profession that still creates an opportunity for everyone to be successful, no matter what your discipline is as an adult.
Frederick Ingram, looking ahead to the upcoming legislative session, is, you know, if there's one thing you would like to come out of that session or come away from that session that would make the lives of teachers better and do something towards retaining some of the teachers that you want to keep around, what would it be?
Well, if I had one thing that I would ask the legislature, it would be to fund our future. Fund the future of Florida as it relates to programs that students care about, band and art and physical education. Those are the programs that keep kids interested. I would ask them to fund our future as it relates to teachers. Make sure that they're funding the future of schools as it relates to the physical plant, having enough technology and books in place so that teachers don't have to go out and spend their own monies, which they so often do. I would ask them to, you know, fund our future and make sure that any decision that they're making as a mandate, that it comes with the proper funding behind it. Don't give teachers any more unfunded mandates. Make sure that evaluations are fair. Make sure that the class sizes are what the Constitution requires them to be. And make sure that they're not only giving lip service to supporting teachers, but they're also prioritizing it by putting it in the budget. Because if you show me your budget, then I'll tell you what your priorities are. And teachers and students and our schools and our families should be the priority of the state of Florida.
So it all comes down to the money. Well, Frederick Ingram is the president of the Florida Education Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, Orlando is trying to curb the city's high rate of pedestrian fatalities. So why does the region keep topping the list for dangerous places to walk and ride a bike? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Orlando region once more tops the list of the country's most dangerous places to walk. That's according to the 5th annual Dangerous by Design report released this month by Smart Growth America. It's frustrating for Orlando's top transportation planner, Billy Hathaway, who says the city's been working on engineering, design and education to try and make the streets safer. I caught up with Hathaway recently at City Hall. Well, Billy Hathaway, Director of the City of Orlando's Transportation Department, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here today, Matthew. Thank you for coming over.
I'm wondering, when you look at the latest Dangerous by Design report, is there anything in there that surprises you? Because the city and folks in the Central Florida area have done quite a lot of work in recent years to try and kind of change the ledger a bit when it comes to making the road safer for walkers and for cyclists. So was that report a bit of a blow to read?
Well, it was certainly disturbing because we have been doing a lot. The city, as you know, funds Bike Walk Central Florida and the Best Foot Forward initiative. So there has been progress, and of course, people should understand that the report is reporting on the about 2.5 million people metropolitan area, which includes the three counties within the region. And one of the things that we at the city are going to be doing is doing a better job of breaking out how we're performing, because we've not seen pedestrian fatalities increase in the same time frame that the report seems to imply.
When you drive around the city, when you walk or when you ride your bike, one thing you'll notice in the last couple months, and we talked to Chris Castro, the sustainability director, a while back about this, is the Lime bikes, right? I mean, there are way more of those bike share bikes on the streets. Just having more bikes around, so more opportunities to cycle, is that going to bring about a bit of a paradigm shift for cycle safety, do you think?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful. As you may be aware, we have 500 of the Lime bikes on the streets, and we've seen as much ridership since November 20th of last year, actually more than we experienced with our other bike share company over the entire of last year. So certainly the fact that there's more bicyclists out there along with increased pedestrians will make drivers more aware that there are bikes out there and that they have to be more conscious of that when they're out and about.
And I'm not sure if this sort of fits into the complete streets model of redesigning or retrofitting city streets, but are you making steps to make changes to other city streets that you've done, like similar to what you've done in the past?
We will be doing that, but I think the more effective way, and this is something that we're doing as part of our update to our bike master plan, is identifying what we would call as bikeways. We've had bikeways identified historically, but we had not done extensive effort in mapping out what streets and corridors are comfortable for really any bicyclist to use. You may or may not be familiar with the Bike Five Cities effort that the city and Bike Walk Central Florida led for the last 2 years, but a big part of that effort is to show people who don't ride regularly that they can get around between all of these five cities without riding on large and higher speed roads. So when we finish up this update to our master plan, part of the goal is to identify these types of streets, basically bikeways that are low volume, low speed, to allow people to get to the trails. And then, of course, once they get to the trails, they can ride in a much more comfortable environment.
And the network of trails in the city has expanded somewhat in recent years. Are there plans to develop more trails down the track?
Absolutely. We recently funded significant portions of the Orlando Beltway, and so that's going to help to connect the city to other parts, the downtown, I should say, to other parts of the city, and also to other trail networks. And of course, our bikeways will also connect into those. The Colonial Overpass will be opening up next month, and that's going to help facilitate crossing, for example, of a very busy roadway and provide a comfortable way for people to get across Colonial.
There's quite a bit of money and planning and engineering that goes into building one of those overpasses, right? And it's just one point on Colonial Drive, and anyone who's driven on Colonial Drive will see people crossing, mid-block, all kinds of situations where it doesn't look particularly safe. But the options really aren't great for pedestrians, are they? So, I mean, this is a step in the right direction, having that overpass, but
It's just one sort of, you know, one thing you can do, right?
It is, and infrastructure is expensive, and that's why the education and enforcement's important. And just having the opportunity to speak on shows like yours helps us to better educate citizens in the Orlando area. But we have, through our Vision Zero efforts, we really expect to see some significant improvements on our high crash corridors.
How are you going to make those improvements?
So as part of our Vision Zero Action Plan, we took the city and broke it down into the six commissioner districts. And in each of those six commissioner districts, our consultant helped us to identify the three corridors that have the highest crashes within each commissioner district. And I think the very interesting and somewhat surprising results of that is that the three corridors in each of those districts account for between 29% and 79% of all the crashes within the commissioner district. So by focusing our funding and working with the Florida Department of Transportation, the District 5 Secretary has already committed to work with us on this because he and I have been talking about both dangerous by design, but also our Vision Zero work. We're hoping to see significant improvements on these, what will be 18 corridors that make up the most critical corridors for us to focus on from a safety standpoint.
18 corridors, I mean, that's a lot of roads. What are some of the standouts? Like, is there one road that you really look at and say, we've got to do something quickly to improve things here?
Well, there is not one road, and thankfully these are segments of roads, so it doesn't mean that necessarily the whole road is a challenge, but certainly specific areas, and so we will be focusing on those segments. And it's made up of both city and state and county roads, so we'll have to work with our funding partners, and the city will be putting in funds from our red light camera program to basically identify how and when we're going to tackle these issues on a quarter by quarter basis. Because, as I shared with you, we're close to finishing up our action plan. What will be next is implementation, and so we have to work with our partners to both get cooperation and funding to help us to address these issues because they're not cheap fixes.
How much money are we talking about?
Oh, gosh. Until we get into the implementation phase, I really couldn't even begin to guess at this point. But I can tell you the work that we're planning to do is the road diet on Robinson Street, and the total funding for that, including the DOT, is going to be in the range of $14 million. So these types of fixes are not cheap.
And explain, if you could, a little bit of detail of what the road diet means. And is it for the entire length of Robinson Street or just a part of it?
No, it's not for the entire length. This segment would go from Garland to Mills, so it's just a portion of the entire length, but it's the portion that has the most pedestrian crossings because we have Lake Eola in that district. And it had a crash problem, which is why the district came to the city about the time I started with the city and said, we'd like to work with you to improve the crash history on this corridor. And we know from Edgewater Drive and national data that you can reduce crashes in the range of 40% to 50% for all types of crashes. So there's significant benefits gained by that. And thankfully, Robinson Street, while it is congested for very short times during the day, by and large, the volumes are well below the threshold for a road diet.
When you talk about road diets, do people sometimes freak out a bit? I mean, there was that experiment or trial done on Curry Ford Road, and there was some pushback on that, right? I mean, people weren't too happy. Some people weren't too happy with it. Some cyclists were happy with it, but a lot of motorists were like, what is going on my street here?
Sure. And I, you know, the thing that I think we have to put into perspective is, you know, we can talk specifically about Curry Ford. So Curry Ford Road is a commuting road, but the fact is that it feeds into three residential neighborhood streets, Bumby, Primrose, and Crystal Lake. So these are residential streets with people who live on those streets. And so these people that are using Curry Ford Road are primarily coming from outside the city limits, and they're using these as an alternative to taking the 408. And so this is cut-through neighborhood traffic that's coming into the downtown. And while it's important to try to address congestion issues, we feel like that we also have to be concerned about about the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of the issue. And yes, there will be, it will force some changes in driver behavior. Road diets are going to create more congestion, but again, the peaks are usually very slow. And in that case, there are a lot of other mitigating factors. We had a very short timeline because of the grant that we had to do this demonstration project with Smart Growth
America. It was like a month, right?
We had a month worth of data collection. We got the notice about 2 weeks before we actually had to do our demonstration project, which told us that we had to have everything done and complete and the data turned in by May, which is not adequate for doing even a demonstration project like that. We would take much more time. We would have had more time to look at signal timing and things of that nature that could have helped mitigate the delay on that corridor.
Just back to the Dangerous by Design report, I know you say you're working on some other things like the Vision Zero project. I mean, that is going to take a little while to get up and running, but is it hard to kind of paint the picture that you want to about what's happening in the city of Orlando if you have this report that comes out every year and it says Orlando is one of the most dangerous places to ride a bike or be a pedestrian? It must be a bit tough sort of fighting that PR battle and saying, look, we're doing some stuff, we're making improvements, it might just not be showing up in the data just yet.
Well, I think that's one thing that the Vision Zero effort is going to be particularly helpful with, because we'll be able to show what the city is doing and accomplishing over time. And thankfully, we've got the support of the district secretary up in District 5, Mike Shannon, who's told me that he's going to be working with us to help address these issues, not just in Orlando, but obviously in the metropolitan areas that were identified in that report to improve safety. But yes, it is discouraging. And the thing that all of us have to recognize, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration historically has identified driver behavior as the cause of 95% of all crashes. So even with us doing the engineering and education component, there's still a driver behavior component that we have no control over. And that's what makes it difficult.
But when, on the flip side of that, I guess when you look at things like what it is that causes pedestrians to get involved in accidents or cyclists, a lot of the times it's design, right? Not having the option of a place to cross or something like that.
So design has a role, there's no question. But the one thing I learned when I was in the private sector is that we in local government also have the ability to significantly change land development patterns. And when you look at the report, you'll notice that most of the states and regions are in the Sun Belt. And all of those regions, just like Orlando, most of our growth occurred after the mid-60s, which is when I left the Orlando area for the first time. And so the types of growth that we've had during that time were all separated land uses. You have neighborhoods with no amenities that are cul-de-sacked onto the state road and federal roads. So all of our state and federal roads have been expanded because of the travel demands put on those roads by development patterns, both commercial and residential. And so that's why we've ended up with these wider, faster roads, and people commute much further than they did before World War II. So it's a combination of things, and that's why it makes it particularly challenging to solve, because we're trying to undo 50 years worth of transportation and land development patterns that contributed to the problem.
Billy Hadaway, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for this show from Abe Abariah and Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.